Welcome to The Study. I'm Craig Robertson, bringing you a program dedicated to the life of the mind. In this program, I have an interview with Nancy Millis, microbiologist. It was conducted with Doug McCann, at the time the honorary librarian with the Royal Society of Victoria. We visited Nancy in her office in the Department of Microbiology at Melbourne University, where she is a professor emeritus. At the time, she was also Chancellor of La Trobe University. Her office is a study of a kind that's piled with books and papers and the signs of hard concentration. She spends her mornings there with the door open, available to students and staff for discussion, advice on all manner of things. We started with her childhood.
I was one of six kids and we were wonderfully well looked after by our parents, neither of whom had had tertiary education, but they were very conscious of the value of this. And fortunately for me, I was totally unaware of this nonce, but they believed the girls were just as educable as the boys. And so we went to good schools, as we all did, and we were encouraged to do whatever we had a wish to do. And that was, I now recognise, a considerable sacrifice to their personal pleasure. And I'm enormously grateful to them for that. I'll tell you one book I enjoyed immensely. It was Alice in Wonderland. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. And I loved the sort of play on words that were made by the turtle and the tortoise and that sort of stuff. I really did enjoy that enormously. And my mother used to read to us as a bedtime story. And, Alice was a great favourite. Mm.
And also Alice Through the Looking Glass?
Yes, indeed. These were all ones that I very much enjoyed from childhood. But that, I would hardly say, was the result. It resulted in my taking on a science career. I think the fact was that when I went to high school, I went to a state school up to through primary school, and then went in secondary school to a grammar school, and was introduced to French for the first time. And I found myself absolutely useless in languages, but I had some capacity in maths and science.
Well, I was a teacher, Winifred Wattle.
Well, she was a remarkable woman, a mathematician of very considerable talent personally, a Cambridge educator, and she really was an extremely important person in influencing people with some capacity. I was introduced to algebra and trigonometry, as they were then called, in the intermediate years and years preparatory to that. She would teach in a way which, if you had some feeling for those things, they were great. But if you were not very good, she would simply say, "Child, do you understand?" And the child would usually say, not in any aggressive way, but simply, "No, I don't." She said, "Well, give it a miss and do French, it's much easier." That was her attitude. And so as a result of that, she creamed off all the kids who had ability and just taught them extremely well. And so I was much influenced by her. But she was a woman of many parts, in that she had an interest in the Australian native flora. And for an English woman, it was perhaps a little unusual, especially at that time. I'm talking about the 30s, 1930s. She was a great outdoors person, rode on the Bogong Highlands in the days when that wasn't at all common. She rode with the cattlemen up there. It was a very interesting lady. I enjoyed her very much. And so she had a great regard, and the school had a great regard, for people who had interest in academic things. It wasn't a school which sort of prepared you for the social life, but rather taught you in a rigorous way.
Nancy suffered a major interruption to her schooling when her father had a heart attack. She was sent to Stotts Business College and wound up as a clerk in an absolutely Dickensian office. But by the early 1940s, she was working as a technician for the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research. She did her matriculation the hard way, studying part-time while she worked.
When I matriculated, I decided, measuring the strength of pieces of timber by lifting up a pendulum and letting it crack and reading the dial, wasn't exactly going to fill my life with joy forever. So I thought, well, I'd better understand what those boys do back there in the office. So I thought I'd do a science degree. And when I went to the university, this was now wartime, they said to me, "Well, how long did you do for a matric?" I told them, which I'd done maths and physics, chem and stuff. And they said, oh, but you've taken a number of years to do that. I said, yes. And I said, oh, I was working. And they said, oh, well, you know, can't have you. So my sister said, when I told her, she said, well, look, why don't you go across and see Sam Mortimer, who was the then Dean of Agriculture, because it's a good course, and he might consider you, see, so I did. And good old Sam, he gave me a go. And so I became a member of that faculty, which put me strongly in the biological side of science, if you like, and very much on the applied side of science. Because the way in which the course was structured in those days, you did essentially a Science 1 course. You did physics, chemistry, and maths with the science student. In the second year, again, you did soil chemistry, which was different, peculiar to the ags. But the botany was the same, the biochemistry was the same, so the physiology was the same. So in fact, you had a very strong science base. It wasn't, in those days, it didn't start to become strongly agricultural till the third and fourth year. And even then, you did a special biochem course, a special micro course, and a special botany course. But even then, they were strongly science-based. And that's, I think, the strength of the course at that time. Now, it's changed since then. It has now become land management and resources, and therefore that sort of management style, economics aspects, which have become the way it's gone, which I think is to the regret of me, who did that other course. But you've got to watch that. I mean, everybody wants to do what they used to do. You said to me, how did I become an academic? Well, it was happened in this way. After I'd done a four-year course, it's a four-year course, I went, who will employ me, you see? And so the Ag Department was one of the few employers of anybody. So I went down there, and they showed me this job on seed testing. And here I saw these kids counting out 100 seeds on blotting paper. God, I did that in kindergarten. I don't particularly want to do that all over again to see how many of them germinated and how many weed seeds and all that stuff. Important though this is, I couldn't see myself doing that for a year. So I'm afraid I told them that I wasn't too interested in that one. And in the meantime, I had this offer of a scholarship to an AMY trust fund, which gave me a very modest salary to complete a master's degree, which I did here in this department. I mean, it was over there on Swanson Street but at the time, but that's where I began to be a microbiologist.
In the late 1940s, Nancy went to New Guinea to work on an agricultural project.
And I was there, I suppose, about 6 months, three of which were horizontal.
You were very ill there in streptomycin, was it?
It was the salvation, as far as I was concerned. Because at first, the only drug they had was penicillin, because the only drug there was. And streptomycin had only just come in. And my sister was able to talk to somebody down here, got me a small amount, shoved it in, and probably saved my life.
Did this stimulate your thinking at all then or later as to,
problems of
production of these drugs? And
well, that was clearly the way the fermentation industry was going. Because up to that time, if you think about the processes that were then in place, ethanol production, lactic acid production, acetic acid production, a little bit of some of the organics, but all of them were either anaerobic processes like the acetone-butanol fermentation or yeast fermentation, or they were so acidic, if they were aerobic, they were so acidic that almost nothing but those organisms would grow. So you had selection by the environment into which these organisms found themselves. And so when you started to make antibiotics, you were talking about a nutrient-rich environment as distinct from a highly selective one, and you were talking about virtually neutral pH, and you were talking about long residence times, and you had to aerate them. So the only aerobic process that was citric, which was in those days a raft fermentation, slow raft fermentation. But if you're wanting to produce antibiotics and you had to aerate them, you needed football fields, and they did, of course, with bottles for quite a number of years.
On recovery, Nancy returned briefly to Melbourne and then went to Bristol University in 1950 to do her PhD thesis on fermentation of cider, and it was here that fermentation became a central interest to her.
When I was offered an interview, I went down, they told me they had three possible topics for the potential scholar. One was glaying in Scottish soils, and I imagined that to be sulphate production in peat bogs, and I thought, God, sitting in a peat bog in Scotland didn't turn me on either. So the other thing was there was a virus disease of strawberries, and I had absolutely no skills in virology, so that was out. And the third one was fermentation of cider, so that seemed to me, what went wrong with that disorder in? So that struck me as being very interesting, so I thought I'd give that a go, so I did. So I became interested in the way in which very large volumes of fluid get handled and what sort of conditions you need in order to control something you don't want versus something you do and so on. So I became interested in the physiology of organisms as a result of that.
And did you try the cider?
Of course, indeed. Yes, I came back here and I was able to go over to US, and this is really where the fermentation industry was going, because what we were talking about now was growing this aerobic creature, Penicillium, in a medium where the pH was neutral, you were blasting air through, so you had the whole problem, how do you sterilize air? Sterilizing a medium, we knew how to do that. But they were not usually blasting air through for 2 days.
Was this the Marvin Johnson?
Yes, Marvin Johnson. Remarkable man, very, very good biochemist at Wisconsin. And he really trained, I would say, a good half of the fermentation industry in the States. A very interesting man indeed.
After Marvin Johnson, you worked at another lab at Stanford, Hopkins Marine
Station. Oh yes, that was great.
And a guy called C.B. Van Neel.
Yes.
And you've written to the effect that he sort of really imparted something of the essence, of, I suppose, of microbiology.
Yes, of course, indeed.
The philosophy he was
then 70, and he'd been teaching this absolutely miraculous course at Johns Hopkins Marine Station, which is near Monterey Bay, you know, Cannery Row.
It was beautiful,
Oh, just a magic place. And he knew names like Cloyver, Bayerink. These names were his mentors. And so
were they sort of founders of the discipline?
Oh, yes. They are real foundation names in the very early days of the Dutch supremacy in much of the early work in microbiology. And he was a student there in Delft and worked with or under Cloyver and Rundgren-Gretzky and those people who really were seminal names.
Well, I was wondering if you could sketch for us some of the key ideas.
Well, for example, Cloyver was the sort of person who put a universal element over biological oxidation, whereas the chemists have always thought of whatever it was, carbon, O2 making something or another, oxidizing, making oxides, in that sense where there was a direct relationship between oxygen. Whereas what Cloyver developed was the concept that most biological oxidations are the removal of hydrogen and making of water as the end product. So that he developed the concept that almost all of the metabolism that we deal about for energy production is due to the removal of hydrogen as a mechanism of oxygen transfer and of energy development. So that was, for example, was a seminal concept which has become so universal that we don't even think about it now. And so that he taught by way of thinking about what did we know at this time? What was the state of knowledge, for example, about glycolysis at this time? And what he did was to take things like glycolysis and put us in the position of the persons at that time as to what did they know or what tool did they need to have in order to get from where they were to the next step. And that was a fascinating story. And he did that with all sorts of different systems. Well, he did, I mentioned glycolysis because everybody thinks about that. And the harm, and the argument between Liebig and Pasteur as to whether the yeast fermentation was a living process or simply, as Liebig would have it, that you excited molecules to react in a chemical way and that there was nothing living about it at all. And, you know, it's fascinating because they're both right, in a sense. They're both right. But it took us a long time to get to the position where we'd say they were both right. That you can have an enzyme that will do these things without its being alive. But at the same time, it was once derived from a living thing.
Yes.
And that was something that had to be put together post-event.
Alan Gifford's The Spell, played by Larry Zitsky. You're listening to The Study, and we're interviewing Nancy Millis, microbiologist.
Japan was the next one, because again, at that time, that was the 60s, the very early 60s, or 59 even. Japan was really paramount in producing metabolites, which ordinarily there in 10 to the minus 5 molar, and they were producing them in grams per litre. And so you were getting amino acids, for example, monosodium glutamate, MSG, and the nucleotide. Well, you would know nori, the green seaweed, wrapped around things. Well, nori is a very important part of Japanese culture and certainly a very important part of their cuisine. They love it. It's important in flavouring. Why is it so? Why does it taste good? And they analysed it and found it was very high in glutamate, which of course is a normal amino acid, but it's usually produced in cells and really only as much. And then at this time, of course, feedback on operons was well known. If you have an amino acid pathway, as your end product piles up, you feed back on the first step of the pathway and it turns it off, so you don't make more than you need. In other words, you only make bricks enough for the wall you've got a need for. And so what these people were able to achieve, and it was an interesting development, were strains of microorganisms which naturally produced more than you would expect of the amino acids. And then they worked at doing it better by mutation. At that time, they didn't have directed mutation, so it was a chance event. You hit them with a hammer and hoped and hunted to find what you were after. It was just extra glutamate in their case. But the idea of auxotrophs was quite common in microbiology in general at that time. This is having a requirement for some growth factor, and amino acids were one of them. And of course glutamate was the one they wanted. Well, they made a strain which was Barton requiring, and when they put a small amount of Barton in, they got a big increase in glutamate. But if they added a lot of Barton, so it was a surplus Barton, then the yield went right down. Now, I really didn't understand what was going on at that time, but they knew how to make it happen regularly, so it was real enough. Later they discovered that the reason that you got such a lot of glutamate made and excreted into the medium was that the membrane was leaking. If they in certain of their strains. And biotin is important in the fatty acid that you produce. So if you've got a biotin deficient organism and feed it just a smidgen so that it stays whole but leaks like a sieve, then the organism says that inside has a very low concentration of glutamate. So, because it's all the time being shot out down the drain, and so it just goes on spewing it out. So that was understood why it worked, but it was empirically discovered in the first place. As time went by in that area, more and more understanding of feedback mechanisms and control systems developed, and so that the pathways to important intermediates were fully understood, and control mechanisms were fully understood, so they can accumulate any amino acid you like.
Can I ask you about the development of modern genetics at the same time? I mean, you're already established in your sort of discipline, and you've got all these other developments taking place, like molecular biology and so on.
Yes.
How did you handle those sort of all of the new stuff? Sort of
well, I would say that I think it's perhaps helpful as a microbiologist that all the pioneering work was done in microbes.
Yes.
I mean, coli is the workhorse for all of this work. And whenever anybody in the plant world wants to get hold of a gene, they pull it out and they put it into coli, grow it up, study it, handle it, and so on. So it's one of our tools, if you like. Everybody else's genetics have really flourished because of this particular tool, in the same way as the Drosophila has been the sort of workhorse for the larger creatures, and Arabidopsis has been the workhorse for the plant people. But they all use the microbe as the sort of thing that pushes them about.
It was the phage work that really changed things, wasn't it?
Well, the work of Boyer, restriction and modification study, which was phage in coli, started the whole of the business of the restriction endonucleases. It was that work. And, you know, if you say to somebody today with an ARC grant, here are two like strains of coli, and here's a bacteriophage which attacks them, but they behave in a strange way. I would like to study this. Betcha! They wouldn't have funded it.
Referring to the battle some years ago now to sequence the human genome, I asked Nancy about intellectual property and where a reasonable balance lies between the public good and the needs of industry.
One of the things that I, if you like, try to think about is that for stuff to be intellectual property that is patentable, you are not able to patent something which you find. In other words, if you discover that a gene has a particular sequence, that of itself is not a patentable piece of information. But if you take that information and you make from it, let's say, a probe which enables you to detect something or to measure something or to treat something, and that process is what you patent. And I don't find a problem with that. But I do have a difficulty where Ventnor originally said, I will patent all the sequence in this organism. Well, now, to me, he has discovered something which is there. He did not contribute. The methods he used were perhaps patentable, but certainly the sequence itself I don't see as a patentable critter. But I do see the possibility, and I mean, we've done some work in the water industry looking at the way in which this is work was done at the University of New South Wales by a very bright young bloke called Brett Nelson. And he uncovered the way in which we've always had difficulty with blue-green algae, the cyanobacteria. Some of them were toxin producers, or sometimes they were toxin producers, and sometimes they weren't, when you had an algal bloom. For many years, people struggled as to whether this was day length of light, or whether it was nutrition, or whether there was some metabolite that turned them on, or whatever. And just all sorts of work was done trying to uncover that. Now, he worked at the level of the molecular stuff and uncovered the fact that it was entirely genetically controlled. They either had the genes for making it, or they didn't. And so that now a probe has been made where you can look for that gene, so that the fundamental work was required first, the tool was created. You can tell from the cell, you can just take them, filter them out, break them open, probe them, yes or no. Now, that's now made freely available to the water industry. But it, the difference that I would see is patenting, finding the gene was not patentable, but making the probe could have been patentable. It was done through the CRC system, and our view was that was public good. And so we didn't patent it.
We went on to discuss the nature of cooperative research centres.
Well, what they were developed for, this was Ralph Slatch's first thing with Bob Hawke, and they were, I think, the best attempt that's been made so far by the government to put industry and researchers together. Because what they required was, the government would put up money, the researchers had to find business partners, industry partners, who wanted what they, the researchers, were doing, or capable of doing. Or they had problems that they thought the researchers could handle. So you had a research portfolio which was supported by industry. Government put up X, industry had to put up, and the researchers had to put up X plus whatever they liked, but they had to put up at least X. So it was an equal contribution or more on the industry side. And that was guaranteed, provided all went well, you had reviews and all that stuff, but provided it went well, you had a 7-year contract. Now the benefit was it was a 7-year contract and the money was virtually guaranteed, which meant that you could get a CEO in place, pay them properly, and have them devote themselves totally to managing that process. Hopefully getting more money out of industry or whatever.
So you're speaking of those in the past now? Are they
no, still, they're still ongoing. They're ongoing. But that's the... When it first began, there were quite a number of what I'll describe as public good CRCs. Ones like the freshwater ecology, where you could hardly say there was an industry in freshwater ecology. What had a right to grow in rivers? What was an environmental flow? These were hardly industry-based. There were others that were frankly industry-based, like various IT and minerals, materials, new concepts, new electronic gee-whizzes or whatever. There were a whole stack of those as well, but there were public good ones as well. Freshwater ecology was one, catchment hydrology was another one, and our one, water quality and treatment, which is one I was connected with particularly, was giving people safe drinking water at an affordable price.
And by and large, do you think these have been, they've been successful in terms of...
In my view, they have in the main been a very successful outcome. Sometimes they've been given, as ours was, a second term, so we've had a second round. But the government said, in fairness to them, that they didn't see these as an ongoing and forever funding commitment. Their idea was that if the industry really wanted what it was you had to give, then after a couple of rounds or thereabouts, you should be so valuable to your industry that they will support you from that point on. And that's the situation which we've reached with our water quality and treatment. We've had two goes. Our industry, the water industry, major urbans, and the rural, regional ones, regard what we're doing as pretty useful. And so we're in the process now of trying to decide how to go from where we will be in 2008 into a new centre, which is essentially industry without government support.
You did some work on the concert hall foundations. Yes. With the...
That was a funny one.
The drainage.
The blokes who were building the concert hall, they had to go down into the mud bank, and that was a very considerable mud bank, very anaerobic, tight sediments, and they had seepage from the groundwater into the lumen of the hall, and they had drains to take that away, and one of these drains, it was just a sink, and the water came in and dropped down into the sink and finally down into the bottom of the system and away. But after a while, this had been going on, they found a great bright brick red stuff in the drop sink, and they wanted to know what the Halifax it was. And so they sent it along to our labs to see what, if anybody knew what earth it was. Well, I had a look at it under the mic, because we thought it might be an alga or something like that. And yet it seemed the wrong colour, the bright brick red. And when I looked at it, it was just like a pile of spaghetti in tomato sauce. The tubes were absolutely even. There were no cuts or suggestion of cells that you'd expect in an alga, like anabena or any of those. So it couldn't be anabena, it couldn't be anything like that. But earth is this thing, because they were very small, but they were exactly like a plate of spaghetti. And as I say, even to the tomato sauce. And so I was just trying to think what the hell they were. And it took me about 2 days to wake up to what they were. There's a particular organ called Leptothrix, which is like a pea shooter. It makes itself, like I say, a spaghetti. And its cells are actually inside, but they shoot out the end. You know, and so what we were seeing was sort of the empty cases of what had once had cells within it. And one of the tricks that these guys can do is to oxidize reduced iron to ferric iron. And so once you get iron hydroxide, of course it goes brick red. And that's what we were seeing all in the slime. And so what to do?
The tubes were the red colour.
Well, they're coated. They're colourless, but the iron gets out, right. And then immediately it's oxidised. It sort of, as I say, you know what iron oxide is like. And so, and because it's all slimy too, as iron hydroxide is. And so that's so it sort of stuck to the walls. And it was fascinating. So what to do? So I thought, well, okay, all you've got to do is stop the oxidation. So provided they put the thing from the outside straight down to the bottom, they wouldn't have a problem with slime at the top, would they? So that's what we did.
Do you go to the concert hall? The concerts?
I often think about it, yes.
You think about it always.
Sitsky playing his own composition, Arch. You're listening to The Study. I'm Craig Robertson, and with Doug McCann, we're interviewing Nancy Millis, microbiologist.
Do you think that our industrial society is ultimately sustainable?
No, we've got to be much more careful than we've been in the past. We've been pretty profligate in the use of water in this country. Reducing demand, using water more efficiently, has got to be something. We've started steadily to move in that direction, but it's got to be much more important that we do it better. Melbourne has probably done better than most cities in developing a total framework to reduce demand. And the strategy that was developed and accepted most recently by the Victorian government is the first group to actually put an act in place which says thou shalt not hose your paths and those sorts of things. Now, hosing paths doesn't save a lot of water. Not hosing paths, I mean, doesn't save a lot of water. It's up here. It's a mindset.
The big one is industry itself, not so much the general public.
No, it's people. 60% of the water used by Melbourne is used by people. It's not used by industry. Industry uses much less than that.
Can I ask one question? This brings in sort of the interface between sort of public opinion and public ignorance, really, yes. some of the issues you do.
Yes.
For instance, GM foods, for instance, this sort yes. of hysteria yes. that comes along yes. with that.
Yep.
How do you handle those sorts of issues?
Well, not well's the answer. It's one of the most difficult issues because water, on the other hand, is easier than GM, so I'll talk about water first. Water is something we all know, we all enjoy, and we all share. And we all know that you've got control over certain of the actions that you undertake with water, and you know turning off the tap is a good way to stop it coming out. So there are a number of fairly simple responses that the person has to make. There are educative tools that you can use. And starting with kids, I think, is the way for that, to get them much more motivated. And trying to persuade people that there are some things you can do by fiat. In other words, dual flush toilets. You can't buy and install a single flush toilet anymore. So we've got nearly to 70% of our toilets are dual flush. Now that of itself is sort of by fiat. Soon by fiat, it'll be washing machines have to be 4A rated. Soon by fiat, any shower has to be an efficient one. So you can do a certain amount by fiat, but on the other hand, the really big user, that is discretionary, is the garden and the laundry, because people tend to put the washing machine on because they're not going like this themselves, so that it can be half full often, and you run it, and then you run it again half full. But you use a top loader, which is three times as wasteful of water as the round and round one, and so on. So there are things like that. So you've got to try and get people used to the idea that you don't use appliances until they're fully doing the task for which they were designed. But that takes time, and lots of people haven't got time or don't want to make time. And if you've got lots of kids, you have lots of nappies and trousers and shirts. That's the household. But outside, the garden, and washing the car, I don't wash my car, but, you know, lots of people wash it every day. They're bad for the gym car.
So I'm wondering how you think, like, are there good ways to implement public participation in government?
Well, so the best you can do is...
So that you don't get a GM food deadlock or something like that.
You have a real difficulty. There are some people who, as far as concerns with GM are concerned, you've got a bunch of concerns which I'll describe as socio-economic. Against God's laws, there are food taboos, there are organic farmers and eaters, there are people who are risk-averse, it doesn't matter what it is that's novel, whatever it is, you stop it if it's novel. So there's a whole bunch of people who, for reasons that are totally unrelated to the particular risk, to any particular risk, they are against something like that. And the real killer for this whole area of concerns is the multinationals. They're worried that the multinationals own the gene, they own the license, and they won't let you keep the seed. So they are worried that the multinationals will command our food supply. Now, personally, I think that's a spurious argument because already farmers buy in seed pretty well every year. So that they're already in the hands of the seed sellers, be they genetically modified or otherwise. And if you're growing special barley so that you get an extra price from the brewers, they won't let you keep the seed out, made by conventional, bred by conventional methods. So that I'm not suggesting that it's necessarily good that those three things are in the one basket, but I am saying it's not a novel problem. And we seem not to have had total command of everything by the seed companies. But you see, that note that none of those issues has anything to do with safety. They're all perception problems. And it's very hard to deal with that. Now, I spend my time saying, well, now, please help me with what is your difficulty. What's your problem? And they say, I don't believe it's against the God's laws or something. Well, I mean, that's a bit like saying, I'm a Buddhist now, tell me I shouldn't be. It's an I believe statement, you can't argue with it. On the other hand, there are people, and there are a lot of them, who are amenable to an argument of that sort. You say, well, will the seed, will the pollen from this particular plant get out? Now, you can address that. Now, you won't always win, because some people will want zero. Now, tell me how to measure zero, and I've been more interested in that too, because it's one of these things you can't put your hand up and say, never, 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 never. All you can say is there's a low probability.
And you can't patent against natural selection.
No. How many people in Melbourne today are walking around with pig heart valves? Lots and lots and lots, hundreds of thousands of people in this country have got pig heart valves. Nobody gets worried about that.
No, and yet a decade ago there was all the hysteria.
Oh, yeah. Terrible to do.
Our next topic was basic research.
Well, as you've heard, I'm very much an applied scientist. But I have never at any time felt that the research that underpins whatever application you make is something that we should not be expanding right now. Because if not, we run out of intellectual capital to apply. In other words, if we're forever using what we now know in our application, we're going to go out the door backwards because we're not advancing processes at all unless we're doing research into the fundamentals of what's going on. So I find that...
And by we, do you mean just...
I'm in the scientific society. And that, as far as Australia's concerned, our manufacturing industry has gone out the door. We haven't got one anymore. We're fast closing down everything we ever made anywhere. Primarily because we're a small country and a small consumer, so I accept that. But at the same time, we have seen industries which should have been going fairly well, not putting money into moving with the times, and as a result, they become overcome by countries that do. And so we go out the door, we can't compete.
Do you think that's possibly part of the reason there is that science has gotten too tied up with technology and producing consumer gadgets and things rather than... I mean, we are strong in medicine, aren't we?
Yes, we are. We're strong in medical research, and our fundamental people there are as good as any that come. And I believe that the work that's been done in many of the CRCs is of that sort. Because they have been close to industry, which says, we want this work done, and certainly the medical groups, we all have problems with diseases we can't cure, so it's well and truly identified where problems are. This lot over here have decided that the area of our anatomy which we know least about is this nut, and so they're interested in brain research. And now there are tools that you can use for brain research, and this is the point I was making earlier. All along the track, you've got a tool like the CAT scans and so on, which can now do things in people whilst they're alive. They can slice their head effectively whilst they're alive with different problems. And so we're gradually moving, along with molecular techniques, into areas which we couldn't look at before. But that's the fundamental stuff. That's until you understand the fundamentals, you'll never be able to cure anything. Most scientists just are interested in the way things work. Because biological things, living things, are so much more complicated than wheels and pistons and rods and cogs, you've got a bigger challenge, and it's just a great big challenge to try and understand. To know what questions to ask is much the hardest part. Devising an experiment to address them, but asking the clever questions is the hard bit. And I'm just not smart enough to ask really smart questions.
Well, I referred to John Silston's book, and he said that sequencing the human genome was a milestone rather than a big idea.
Yes, that's
like,
that's exactly right.
Once they knew what to do, it was just a question of
well, I remember,
getting there eventually.
I remember Charles Brenner gave a talk over at La Trobe, And somebody talked to him, you know, the matter of the genome research. He said, look, if I had a really stupid student, that's what I'd give them to do.
We're saying, like, it's just part of a process that was begun by organic chemistry, bridging the gap.
The clever part was devising the way in which you do this. Yeah. But to go and do it is soul-destroying.
That's right. Given that context, like, well, what does microbiology have? A set of bigger, like you referred to the Dutch origins of the discipline, of the key insights we talked about before. I mean, does it have certain big ideas or big theories?
Big questions
at the moment, as a discipline of its own?
Of course, yeah. It certainly does. I mean, not to say that microbiology includes immunology, but the branch of immunology, the whole world of immunology is just blown in complexity. And why cells die when they should die? You know what I mean? Programmed cell death. They give it the lovely name of apoptosis, which I think is lovely. It's a very onomatopoeic phrase for programmed cell death, because we've got to have cells die off. And it's got to do it in a programmed way. And many cancers are when that fails to do the job, instead of dying when it surely grows. So trying to understand that process is very interesting. And that's a whole bunch of folk, lots and half the hall is interested in apoptosis.
What about the origin of life going the other way from...
Well,
does microbiology address that at all?
Well, many of the simplest creatures are thought to resemble the archaebacteria, so-called. They are the most primitive that we know about in terms of entities that can reproduce themselves, as distinct from viruses, which require a host cell. But bacteria are certainly thought to be the most primitive of these, and we have very good evidence that many of the more complicated cells are actually taking bits of bacteria, putting them inside mitochondria, for example. Pretty well, certainly.
Do you feel that microbiology is one of those sort of central sciences, in the sense that there's so many other disciplines that interact with it and depend on
I think one of the things that really is the unifying thing at the moment in biology is molecular biology.
Yeah.
Because the code is the same for us all. Whether you're a bean, a banana, or a banker, you know, it's all the same. So that it's certainly the molecular aspect is the fundamental. But control mechanisms are clearly different, and that's the challenge.
Have the arts sort of inspired?
Oh, certainly. I think that an appreciation of what grows and how it grows is one of the things that has certainly influenced the way in which you conduct, particularly in the water world, how do you build a dam in a place in such a way that you do the least possible damage? How do you manage a catchment so that a number of things can happen there with the least impact on, or undesirable impacts? Those sort of things, I think, are very synergistic.
Do you think there's an aesthetic factor?
Yes, I think there's an aesthetic factor there, as well as a straight practical one. And I think if people have some sort of a feel for aesthetics, they're more likely to be sensitive to the environment in which you're working. Well, I find it just extraordinary that we have a Minister for Education who is espousing intelligent design as a requirement in curriculum.
Oh, this is Nelson.
I don't know what you'd call it. I think it's just a travesty of anything that... just unbelievable. They're going back to the Scopes trials, for God's sake. I mean, I find it just extraordinary that this total failure... I mean, it's... As long as they taught it, I suppose, like the myths of Greece or somewhere...
There is this issue of truth, and some people think, for example, that science is the guardian of truth. Other people think it can be said that there are higher truths than science.
I think one has to accept that for some people they have a mind which says I can believe in some greater God and a greater spiritual creature, and I will go to some Valhalla in the skies or down below or wherever else. Now, I can't argue with that, but I can't find myself convinced of that position. But I don't deny them.
There could be a moral truth too, that, for example, that you shouldn't tamper with what is supposedly natural. That's a big question, wouldn't it? What is natural?
Well, indeed, because we've been bombarded by UV light, and we have been mutated since forever. So that mutation from outer cosmic UV and all these other rays that have been hitting us, we know very well, because we can put them ourselves and increase the rate of mutation. So there's every reason to believe that they, over millennia, those rays have been impacting upon biological material all this time. So there's no reason to believe it hasn't been happening. And we also know from plenty of experiments, and microbiology does this particularly well, set up a chemostat with a, say, penicillin resistance gene included in the organism, have penicillin in the feed, and every organism coming out the other end of the chemostat will be penicillin resistant. Put the same feed in, but leave the penicillin out, and in about four generations, most of them don't carry the gene.
In fact, that's probably the first real practical proof of natural selection, isn't it?
Really? It certainly is. Yeah. It certainly is. Mm. And we do that as a class experiment. as a supervisor of students, you offer a problem, an issue, something that they might like to investigate. You give them as free a go as you possibly can manage. And you have the door open all the time. If they want to come in and talk, they do. And you give them personally as much freedom as they want, and have them feel that they can come and talk with you or with anyone else. Because there are lots of other people who know lots of stuff. So talk to them. And they'll come to me, and if I don't know, I just ring somebody up and say, hey, what do you know about it? Blah, blah, blah. And we do it that way. I'm very relaxed about that. I don't think there's one way to teach students, because some of them need lots of help. Others of them are so bloody rough, they rise above their instruction in a flash. And that's absolutely wonderful when you get one of those. And, you know, you don't have to do anything more than poke them at a problem. And away they go. So I believe that the more freedom you can give to a student, the more independent they are when they finish, ready to go out and take on anything. And my take-home message to kids, if I talk to them, is, well, look, you've got basic training in this area. If something comes along, even if you've never met it before, but you believe what you now know in this general area is relevant to that problem, then you have every reason to say, I'll give it a go. Well, I've exhausted you all.
Study is a self-funded and self-motivated project, so when I sit in my study and ponder the choices I have, I do tend to need some rationale for it, if I can offer some of my thinking. The opening ceremony of the Sydney Olympics in 2000 was celebrated as a great pageant of Australian life, and rightly so in many ways. Its representation of Indigenous and other aspects of our culture was quite laudable. But maybe I took a toilet break at the wrong moment. I didn't see any representation of our intellectual life. Amongst all the Blundstone Boots and Victor Mowers, where were the scientists, the writers, the artists? There was a reference to Sidney Nolan's Ned Kelly paintings. A brief appearance by Yvonne Kenny was all we got for high culture. The ceremony reached a high point when three people were wheeled out on big white pedestals. At least two of them were of dubious merit, even for fans of popular culture. Depending on how you define an Australian, we've won up to 9 Nobel Prizes. There were 7 then and 2 since the Games. All but one of these, Patrick White in literature, were in science and mostly biomedical science, an area where we are told we punch above our weight. One of those Nobel Prize winners, Peter Doherty, had won as recently as 1996. There was no pedestal for him, although I doubt that he'd want to get up on one. I think this reflects an anti-intellectual streak that runs deep in Australian life. I think it's supposed to be part of our larrikin character, but I also think it's a failure of character. It holds us back with regrettable consequences. We don't value education enough, especially we don't value research enough. Something I put to Nancy Millis when she spoke about basic research. We don't value creative intellectual endeavour generally enough. So just see who gets the pedestals any day. There's a strange confluence of this attitude with that of the supposed economic rationalist bean counters. Shelley Gehr, a Sydney author, discusses this in a recent book called The Triumph of the Airheads. The bean counters insist on cutting funds from anything that doesn't attract a big enough market, not just philosophy, physics, but science in general, music and languages. But the university as an institutional ideal itself suffers. The pervasive postmodernist culture certainly doesn't care, being disdainful of all those things. So it's no wonder our universities have suffered such poor government support. But there lies the strength of the anti-intellectualism. The cutbacks have happened at the very time the universities have proven their strength in the global education market. Any agricultural sector that was achieving the same degree of success would be getting strong assistance. Another thing, a few years ago, a major anniversary of Gallipoli occurred, and the last handful of old diggers received a lot of media attention. Everyone wanted to interview them. I've no argument with that. I just think that there are also many old people who worked long and distinguished careers in the arts, the humanities and the sciences, who are left now to die away unacknowledged. One could argue that each of the last 4 centuries was a watershed in science, but none was more tumultuous than the 20th century. We still have among us many whose lives span most of that century, yet they are passing from us unnoticed. And of course, many, in fact, are still working. They have stories that should be told and should be known to the public. The study interviews try to redress this situation in some way. It's about intellectual history. The great philosopher and mathematician A.N. Whitehead once wrote a book called Adventures of Ideas, itself an idea that appeals a lot to me. Music in this program included Larry Sitsky playing his own piece Arch and The Spell by Helen Gifford, and also our 2 regular themes, Elizabeth Anderson playing Handel's Suite on harpsichord and Ronald Farren Price on piano playing Mark Brown. They're all on Move Records. Please see the study website at study.net.au for more details. And so, until next time, it's Shut the Door and Reading Lamp Only in the Study. Thank you.